You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 3rd of December 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with Phil Hahn and me, Guy Delaunay.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, James Boyes from King's College London is here to set the day's news agenda. James, what are we talking about today?
Well, this morning the 2016 global primary continues as a leading Republican flies into London. Amazon considers flying its gifts to you by a private drone, and Vice President Biden flies into Japan to try and save President Obama's bacon.
There's a lot of flying there. More from James in a moment. Also ahead, the comeback of Saab, the Swedish automotive icon, is back in production. But how tempted are its Chinese investors to move the factories to the east?
Plus, we also examine the art of the sign and why the profession of sign making is doing so well in South Korea, of all places.
I feel the most effective way to advertise is still signs. Even though people are into their iPhones or tablets and still search for things using that technology, signs still work.
Also, architectural ideals gone wrong. We visit Sao Paulo, where there's controversy surrounding a world-famous museum. Is it the art that's attracting visitors, or the drug sales at the meeting point?
All that plus, we'll play some music, and we'll also look through this morning's European front pages as well. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
But first, let's catch up on the headlines with Bonnie Burnham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. The Ukrainian Prime Minister Mykola Azarov has accused opposition politicians and protesters of trying to overthrow a legitimate government. Opposition groups have called for a vote of no confidence in the cabinet over what they say is a lurch back towards Soviet-style rule from Moscow. They've called for a general strike after hundreds of thousands demonstrated against President Viktor Yanukovych's decision to abandon an EU integration deal. Meanwhile, the UN Secretary-General Ban Ki-moon has expressed his concern over the situation. His spokesman, Martin Nazirki, says Mr. Ban is monitoring the situation.
He appeals to all parties to act with restraint, avoid any further violence, and to uphold the democratic principles of freedom of expression and peaceful assembly. The Secretary-General encourages meaningful dialogue between all concerned in the pursuit of a prosperous future for Ukraine and mutual agreement among Ukrainians on the path forward for the country.
The Thai government says it's ordered police confronting anti-government protesters in the capital, Bangkok, to stand down to avoid violence. Following the order, officers looked on as protesters cut razor wire and removed barriers outside Government House. Earlier, riot police had fired tear gas at protesters who were gathered there to continue their campaign to topple the government of Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawatra. Police spokesman Pia Utayo.
In order to reduce the tension between the protesters and the police, the Centre for Administration of Peace and Order have opened barriers to let protesters come in the compound area of the government house. We're in the process of negotiation with the police. Police still maintain peace and order. Forces from military still safeguard the area and ready to reinforce police operations.
Investigators say a New York commuter train which derailed on Sunday, killing four people and injuring 60 others, was travelling over the speed limit when it went off the track. Preliminary data from the train's event recorders showed that its brakes engaged fully just 5 seconds before it came to a complete stop after the crash. 11 people remained critically injured. One man suffered a spinal cord injury which could leave him paralysed from the neck down. Earl Wiener of the National Transportation Safety Board.
The preliminary information, and let me emphasise this is preliminary information, from the event recorders shows that the train was travelling at approximately 82 miles per hour as it went into a 30-mile-an-hour curve. That speed, again, was 82 miles an hour at the entrance to a 30-mile-an-hour curve.
The United States has called for the immediate release of an American contractor jailed for the past 4 years in Cuba, saying his continued captivity is gravely disappointing. 64-year-old development worker Alan Gross was arrested in Havana 4 years ago today for his work on a semi-covert US program promoting political change on the island. Gross said he was in Cuba to set up communications equipment to give unrestricted internet access to Jewish groups. He was jailed for 15 years after a judge ruled that the activity was subversive and a crime against the Cuban state. Bob Dylan's being investigated in France after a Croatian community organisation alleged that comments he made to Rolling Stone magazine last year amounted to incitement to racial hatred. He was quoted as comparing the relationship between Jews and Nazis to that between Serbs and Croats. The formal investigation followed a legal complaint from the Council of Croats in France, which alleged that the comments, as carried in the French version of the magazine, violated French racial hatred laws. An almost forgotten US novel published in 1965 has won the Waterstones Book of the Year Award in the UK. Stoner, written by the late John Williams, is about William Stoner, a Missouri literary scholar struggling with his marriage and career. The book sold only 2,000 copies in a year before going out of print. But a 2011 translation into French helped it become a bestseller in France and the Netherlands, after which it took off worldwide. Other contenders on a shortlist of six included Booker Prize-winning Julian Barnes's Levels of Life and graphic novel The Gigantic Beard That Was Evil by Stephen Collins. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Barney. It is 6 minutes past the hour here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One here in London. It's time now to set the day's agenda. In the studio with us is James Boyes, Senior Visiting Fellow at King's College London. James, welcome to the program. There's a very special American in town. Who is it?
Well, there is indeed. The gentleman is Senator Marco Rubio. And I think what's interesting here is that obviously, we're going to be talking an awful lot about the presidential election that's coming up in 2016 in a few years' time. But you're starting to see, I think, the emergence of what I call the global primary. The idea that it's not enough now that candidates campaign within the United States. They are now, if you will, inflicting themselves upon the rest of the world. And where better to do that than London? In 2008, you might recall President, then Senator Obama, barnstormed through Europe, Berlin and London. In 2012, Mitt Romney came to London, very much trying to seek international prestige. Now we're seeing a series of candidates. Hillary Clinton was here 6 weeks ago. Marco Rubio is here now. Both have chosen to address Chatham House. Both have been meeting with senior members of the British parliamentary organizations whilst they're here. So this idea that Americans are now trying to elevate themselves to global statesmen before they even become president, I think is certainly worthy of note.
It's franchise extension, isn't it? It's like the NFL teams coming to play a match at Wembley.
You're not wrong. You know, people often think of us as the 51st state. How long it is before we vote, one wonders at this rate. Maybe Scotland will move out, we'll move across the pond, and we'll settle things for all.
It's great. It's all and well to have these individuals come overseas and you know, make these big speeches at these different think tanks. But it really is just the mom and pop voter in places like New Hampshire or Iowa that are going to be voting for their leader. So do they really care so much about whether they're making speeches in London at Downing Street or in Ottawa? You know, does that really matter?
Well, you're absolutely right on one level, of course. It is mom and pops who are going to be voting in Hawaii, New Hampshire, particularly very importantly in those states. But what I think you're seeing is an attempt by the politicians, in this case, not to appeal to average voters, but this is very much an appeal to the hierarchy within the parties to try and talk about a sense of inevitability, talking about a sense of gravitas, presenting themselves as a president in waiting, if you will, not necessarily to the people on the ground, but to the hierarchies, the grandees, and also, I think, to other fellow candidates to say, crikey, this person is well-received overseas. Mm-hmm. Who am I to challenge them effectively? And to try and look at the inevitable candidate going into the primary. Where those mom and pops will be initially voting.
And I think it's fair to say that this is particularly the case with Marco Rubio. He needs this gravitas because I'm obliged to say that he's a young guy, James, because he's younger than me.
He's younger than I am, absolutely. Yeah.
And he's very junior in the Senate as well, hasn't held a seat in the Senate for particularly long.
Doesn't it make it sick when people are running for the presidency and they're younger than you are?
Yeah, it's never happened before.
No, myself, absolutely. So it is remarkable. You're absolutely right, though. This is a chap who came along out of thin air, effectively, in 2002, swept the board, swept to power. A lot of light on him. A lot of people, as always, referring to him as another John F. Kennedy. Here we go again. But he also had a major problem. He was chosen to give the Republican response to the presidential State of the Union recently. That backfired quite badly when he had to grab for a bottle of water at that point, and people were referring to the brand of bottle of water perhaps more than to what he said personally. So it'll be interesting to see how he does. He does need to add some weight to this rather charismatic resume that he does have.
And of course, I recall Tim Pawlenty from 2012. Of course, many people heralding him as the next John F. Kennedy. He became one of the biggest flops, wasn't he, of the Republican Party. Well, let's just take the temperature very briefly, though, James, of the 2014 primaries, which are coming up. Of course, many people after the government shutdown thought it was the Democrats who were up and ahead. And of course, the latest polls show that now is no longer the case because of the healthcare debacle. Long way to go still, isn't there?
You're absolutely right. The British Prime Minister, Harold Macmillan, famously once said, "What do you fear most in politics? Well, it's events, dear boy, events." And it's so true always. In the United States, everybody was assuming that the Democrats were going to do well because of the government shutdown. Just, you know, a blink of an eye later on, now all of a sudden the Republicans are in the Senate seat because of the Obama healthcare initiatives. The White House has pledged that those problems are going to be rectified and apparently are moving quickly in that direction. But there's no doubt at the moment that it's almost like a plague on both their houses at this point. There was a poll out recently which seemed to suggest that people would be very happy if all members of the House of Representatives, who are, of course, all up for re-election, were all defeated. So there clearly is no love lost between members of Congress and the American people at this rate.
Now, talking of Obama, he's well known for another initiative, which is drones. And there are other things you can do with drones other than bomb wedding parties in Pakistan and Yemen. Amazon.com
really?
Have... apparently, according
I missed
to,
that.
According to Amazon.com, they could be used for, I don't know, more peaceful means, like delivering things to people.
Well, you're absolutely right. And this is the evolution of drones. They actually did begin very much as a photographic platform, looking down, trying to find people before they started putting hellfire missiles upon them. Now, all of a sudden, Amazon are saying, well, you know what, we can do more than just kill people or find people or look for people with these things. We can actually help people with these things, and we can deliver with these things. We've seen here in recent days the privatization of the Royal Mail. People fear that post offices are going out of business. Well, guess what? Maybe the postman will become a thing of the past now. The idea that Amazon want to deliver mail deliveries by drones to you. Quite how this works out feasibly is going to be very, very difficult to understand. In the United States, the Federal Aviation Authority are up in arms about this, saying, well, this just can't possibly happen. One wonders, though, in 10 years, whether we'll be looking back and thinking, do you remember the day when things weren't delivered by drone and people used to deliver mail? What a remarkable thing that must be.
And because civilian airspace in the U.S. is going to be open up to these drones in something like 2015, after the FAA comes up with some kind of regulation to, I guess, manage these flying objects all over the country. Well, James, let's just briefly touch on your final subject for us. Vice President Joe Biden is in Asia to try to, I guess, put a damper on some rising tensions in that part of the world. Can he do it?
Well, let's see. You might remember there's great fears here in Europe, if you remember, a couple of years ago when people were talking about the Pacific pivot that Obama was talking about. In Asia, it must be pointed out, however, they are very concerned that this isn't actually happening and that the move towards a Pacific-based foreign policy has basically left office along with Hillary Clinton. It's fascinating, I think, that it's Biden who's gone over there very much to try and reassure the Japanese about U.S. relationships with China, and not, say, for example, the Secretary of State or the National Security Advisor. Once more, I think you can see an example of Joe Biden rushing to President Obama's rescue. He did it very much over the government shutdown. We've seen it with regard to other issues as well. And the idea, I think, that Biden is almost like the wise man, quite ironically, of this administration should give us pause for thought.
Will he run for president?
Well, this is the great thing. I mean, he's clearly a leading candidate. He is vice president. He should be the presumptive Democratic nominee. nominee. If only it wasn't for an individual called Hillary Clinton, there's no doubt, I think, that he would be the leading candidate. At the moment, the president is trying to sit on the fence about this. There's no doubt that Hillary believes it's her time, and she'll be courting the delegates assiduously over the next 3 years, I assure you.
It will be fascinating to watch who Obama is going to support in that primary. Yes. Who do you think he will?
He's going to sit that out as long as possible, and I think he's going to put a finger in the wind and wait to see which way the prevailing wind blows. I think it'll go Hillary's way myself, and he'll come out only when it's very clear who the winner will be.
For the moment, he's Biden has time.
Very true.
Very good.
Excellent stuff, James. And, of course, Guy, clever as always. James Boyes, senior visiting fellow at King's College London. Thanks very much for joining us on the program.
Coming up, Saab finally starts making cars in Sweden once more. But could it all be for null, as they say over there?
The menu brings you the culinary stories and tales that are sure to inspire. From cake, steak and tapas to oysters, chicken and caviar, the menu roams the world in search of the best things to eat and the best places to eat them in. We uncover the trends that are taking hold and interview those spearheading a gastronomic movement.
The spirit in there represents the legacy of everything where we have been involved in the rum-making business. You have to taste it to believe it.
Okay, can we take Peruvian food back to London? Different type of corns, you know, a different type of cheese. And I knew at that stage, yeah, this is good.
So if you don't know the difference between a Salzburger Knockel and Kolonskink, a head cheese and a Faluda, tune into the menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours London time. I hope you're hungry.
That's The Menu, in association with Krug.
Welcome back to the programme. It's 0917 just about in Stockholm, 0817 here in London. Now, say Saab, Phil, and what comes to mind?
Not sure.
well,
maybe a couple of years ago I knew, but not so much anymore.
And there's a reason for that, isn't there? But for me, it conjures up images of ignition switches next to the gear lever, quirky seatbelt systems, and very cool convertibles. Saab started in 1947 and quickly became one of the world's most distinctive car marks, exemplifying the craftsmanship of its Swedish makers. But it's gone through an extremely rough recent patch, and in 2011, Saab declared bankruptcy and it was sold to a Chinese investment firm.
But finally, just finally, since going bankrupt, Saab restarted yesterday the production of its 9-3 sedan model in a Western Sweden factory. Now, it is a long time coming for the company, but is it enough to revive its dwindling fortunes? Well, joining us on the line from Stockholm is Jonas Fröberg, automotive editor of Svenska Dagbladet newspaper. Welcome to the program, Jonas. This is an exciting day, I guess, for Saab, finally to be restarting production back home in its native country.
Yeah, it's a big day, but you have to keep in mind it's a very, very subtle start. They will start with making two cars per day, so it's a very slow and brittle start, I would say.
Two cars a day, that sounds more like a sort of boutique sports car manufacturer. and is this 9-3, is it still the old sort of Opel Vectra platform that they're working on here, or have they upgraded it?
No, they haven't. We have to make it clear that the car they're slowly starting to manufacture now is it's a 12-year-old car, that the 9-3 that Saab used to do. Basically, it's the same car as they did in 2011. They are working on a new platform, a new scalable platform that they are putting a lot of money in, but that won't be due until perhaps 2, 3, 4 years, if the Chinese owners are adding money into this project.
Yes, that just seems to completely boggle the mind that Saab would be restarting production on a 12-year-old car model while other car manufacturers are trying to engage as much new technology as possible.
I mean, economically, seen as a business project, it's a catastrophe. I mean, I've been asking, when will you have a positive cash flow? I have not received any answer, to put it mildly. I mean, well, the reason they're starting the factory is, I think, twofold. First of all, the factory costs a lot of money just, you know, standing there. They have to have maintenance and stuff. Secondly, they want to create some buzz around the brand again, because Saab is about to be forgotten, and what people tend to have in mind, the top of mind when it comes to Saab, is all the hassle and all, you know, this long 2 years until they went into bankruptcy 2 years ago.
But how can Eunice, how can you create buzz with a car that's 12 years old when you're seeing other manufacturers like BMW coming out with their i-series of electric cars, which everyone is talking about?
Yeah, I think they will basically sell cars to China. I mean, that's the new business model. I mean, the European car market is going down for the sixth year in a row. Of course, they cannot compete on the European market. They will, people, the one who want to buy Saab can order one through the web page of the company, which is a bit bizarre. But then the big thing here is that a city in China called Qingdao, they are an owner of almost 25% of the company. They went in as an owner about a year ago, and thing is, all new money into this Saab company will not be put in the west of Sweden. They will be put in a new joint venture between this city of Qingdao and the Saab company.
So do you actually think, Jonas, that, I mean, the implication of that is that the money is going to go into production in Qingdao, and that maybe the Swedish facilities will be left to wither on the vine?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the Swedish facility will be there for another, I can't even guess, 5-6 years, whatever. But they have already looked at a place, at an at actual physical place for the factory in China. A Swedish state secretary have already been there and been, you know, talking to the communist mayor of the city and been very polite and all that. So I think what we're seeing here is the Chinese, they want the technology, they want the know-how around electric cars, and they want to manufacture them in China eventually. That's my interpretation of all this. And the thing is, for Saab, I think it's great that they are starting to manufacture cars. All people in Sweden, I think, are thinking, they're really hoping that they will pull this off. But I think we have to be realistic and see that the future is in China. And if you have Chinese owners, they're not interested in creating jobs in Sweden. They are interested in you know, getting the technology and getting cars to China.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Jonas. That's Jonas Froberg, the automotive editor of Svenska Dagbladet newspaper, bringing a dose of realism to our hopes for Saab there, I think, Phil.
And welcome back. It is 16:23 in Shanghai. It is 8:23 here in London. You're listening to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Guy Delaney.
Time now to check in with our man in Shanghai. And joining us today is our contributor there, Justin Bergman. Welcome to the show, Justin.
Hi there.
Now, it's the big auction house punch-up, isn't it? Christie's versus Sotheby's.
Yes. Yes. Sotheby's had their first major auction in China this past weekend, and it comes a couple months after Christie's held its first auction in Shanghai. Both of these auction houses are being allowed into the country for the first time this year. They've gotten licenses in order to try to take advantage of the lucrative Chinese art market. They've been, you know, fixtures in Hong Kong for many, many years, but this is the first time they've been able to have auctions inside the country.
And can you give us a sense, Justin, of the types of pieces of art that they're buying at these auctions? Is it Western art, or is it indeed art from China and art from Asia?
Yeah, well, actually, it's interesting is that both auction houses are taking slightly different tactics here. Sotheby's, in their first auction, was focusing solely on Chinese art. So, you know, they were going after very, very wealthy collectors, and they sold about $37 million worth of art, the highest price going to a work by a Chinese painter named Zhao Woqi, who sold a work for $14.7 million. So that's what Sotheby's is doing. Christie's is going after a slightly different audience, slightly lesser affluent art buyers. And they're selling everything from Picasso's to a Warhol to a wine and jewelry. So, you know, Western art isn't usually seen in auctions in Asia that often, but in their first auction a couple months ago, that's what they were focusing on.
How many hoops have they had to jump through in order to get these mainland China operations up and running?
Well, it's been difficult for, you know, the market here is actually dominated by Chinese auction houses, and the government has been quite protectionist until this year when they finally gave licenses to Sotheby's and Christie's. Obviously, they're getting something out of it. These are joint deals with Chinese companies that have allowed them to do this. But what Sotheby's and Christie's can offer art buyers here that the Chinese auction houses can't is a level of guarantees on authenticity. You know, forgery is a major issue in China, as it is all over Asia, when it comes to art, and the Chinese auction houses have had a hard time maintaining quality control.
Justin, let's move on to another topic which you've highlighted for us, and this, of course, is in Taiwan, that country contemplating a same-sex marriage bill.
Yeah, then this is this would be the first country in Asia to pass a law like this. You know, it certainly has to go quite a ways, but it's divided the island with about half and half, those in favor, those against. There was a major protest this past weekend with some say about 100,000 people attending, which was against the passage of the law. But, you know, a few weeks ago there was an equally large gathering in support of it. You know, Taiwan is an interesting case because it is a very, very tolerant and one of Asia's most liberal societies when it comes to gay rights, but it is still quite touchy when it comes down to individuals and families. You know, a lot of gay men and women do not come out to their families. It's still kept very secret. So, you know, this could go a huge this could be a huge step forward in Asia in general.
I do see that a recent opinion poll suggests that more than 50% of people in Taiwan support legalizing same-sex marriage. That appears to be an astonishingly progressive society.
It really is. I mean, when you go to Taiwan, you do sense a real openness when it comes to gay rights. Gay bars are very open. People can hold hands in the streets. There's really no discrimination whatsoever that happens very overtly. Where it does come into play is when families, you know, worry about their children coming out to them, and gay people do keep it quiet from their families in to a large extent.
And Justin, speaking of openness, there's some interesting developments with a very famous Chinese director who seems to be having a bit too much fun.
Yeah, I guess you could put it that way. This is the famous director Zhang Yimou, and he is in trouble in China for fathering too many children, apparently. There were rumors going around in the last couple months that he had fathered maybe seven, maybe eight children. You know, this is in violation of the Chinese authorities' very strict rules on how many children you can have. And finally, Mr. Zhang had to come out this weekend and issue an apology to the country. And he admitted that he does have three children with his current wife, in addition to a fourth that he fathered with his previous wife.
My goodness, when's he sleep?
Exactly.
Is it really, I mean, again, is this highlighted? We've had this one-child policy in China for an awfully long time, and of course the replacement rate, the birth rate, is catastrophic, really, in China. Is this at least provoking a debate again about whether this policy should be reviewed?
Well, it is being reviewed. You know, just a couple weeks ago, the authorities issued a massive review of this, changing some of the rules for people who are only children are now allowed to have more than one child themselves. But I guess what's happened with this case in particular is that people online have been very upset at the different treatment when it comes to celebrities versus ordinary Chinese in this rule. You know, people were very upset that the authorities couldn't track Zhang Yimou down for a very long time. They weren't sure where he was. And, you know, a lot of people saying if this was an ordinary Chinese person, they would have had to have paid huge amounts of fines or even had, you know, forced sterilization, forced abortions, things like that. So, you know, there is an outcry over the different treatment between the rich and the not-so-rich.
Fancy that happening in China. It wouldn't happen anywhere else in the world, would it? Justin, thanks very much for joining us from Shanghai. That's Justin Bergman once again on for us.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
And in the next half hour of the program, we'll be reviewing this morning's European front pages. We'll also look at the downfall of Sao Paulo's Museum of Art. And we'll also flip the switch and look at the digital advances made in signage.
I feel the most effective way to advertise is still signs. Even though people are into their iPhones or tablets and still search for things using that technology, signs still work.
But first, here's Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Thanks, Guy. The Ukrainian Prime Minister has accused opposition politicians and protesters of attempts to overthrow a legitimate government. Opposition groups have called for a vote of no confidence in the cabinet over what they say is a lurch back towards Soviet-style rule from Moscow. The Thai government says it's ordered police confronting anti-government protesters in the capital Bangkok to stand down to avoid violence. Following the order, officers looked on as protesters cut razor wire and removed barriers from outside government house. Investigators say a New York commuter train which derailed on Sunday, killing four people and injuring 60 others, was travelling at more than twice the speed limit when it went off the track. 11 people remain critically injured. The United States has called for the immediate release of an American contractor jailed for the past 4 years in Cuba, saying his continued captivity is gravely disappointing. 64-year-old development worker Alan Gross was arrested in Havana 4 years ago today for his work on a semi-covert U.S. program promoting political change on the island. Bob Dylan's being investigated in France after a Croatian community organization alleged that comments he made to Rolling Stone magazine last year amounted to incitement to racial hatred. He was quoted as comparing the relationship between Jews and Nazis with that between Serbs and Croats. An almost forgotten US novel published in 1965 has won the Waterstones Book of the Year Award in the UK. Stoner, written by the late John Williams, sold only 2,000 copies in a year before it went out of print. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Barney. Barney will be back at the top of the hour with another check of your world headlines. But you are indeed listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn, and Guy Delaney.
Now, as Roland Barthes would confirm, signs tell us a lot of things.
They do.
They do indeed. Like where to go.
You'd hope so.
Where to go, what's for sale, and what's on the menu. In South Korea, sign makers are keeping up with the latest technological advances in offline digital advertising. And the work of these designers was recently on show at a sign design expo. Our correspondent in Seoul, Jason Struther, dropped in to take a look for this week's Section D.
If you love the smell of ink, then this is the place to be. There are hundreds of industrial-sized printers all around me. They're spitting out vibrantly colored advertising posters from all sorts of companies. I spot a vodka advert and a Van Gogh reprint, just to name a couple. There are also flashing LED panels everywhere that burnt holes into my retinas. And there's a gang of men in matching blue outfits shaping pieces of metal into 3D letters. 200 South Korean companies are taking part in the 21st annual Korea Sign, or COSIGN Expo. They range from small design shops and manufacturers to big-name firms like Korea Telecom. It's a one-of-a-kind event, says Kim Tae-young of COEX, the convention center that puts on COSIGN. He says it's a great venue for Korean sign makers to show how they're keeping up with the changing industry.
Traditionally, sign makers would use machines to make signs, or other forms of advertising. But now companies are much more focused on digital signage. I think this year, the event is trying to put more emphasis on public designs.
What are public designs?
Public design is about the appearance of a city. Things like outdoor signs, transportation screens in bus shelters or on benches. We're trying to match up designers that use LED lights or other digital forms of signage with those in the public sector.
Kim also explains that the digital revolution of sign design has significant environmental benefits.
Sign advertisements are considered a type of visual pollution. It really doesn't help a city's appearance. Too many signs can confuse people, and, of course, there are environmental problems when disposing of old signs. Digital signs can limit these concerns, and when you use them with LED lighting, it enhances their efficiency. That's why the government is promoting the use of digital signage.
Kim says that in Seoul, there are laws that prevent the use of conventional painted signboards, so digital and LED are really the future of advertising here. Back on the convention hall floor, I walked over to the guys hammering and bending metal into both English and Korean letters. They work for the company 1AM, and manager Teddy Yoon tells me about the types of signs they're making.
People are using the, you know, the channel letters instead of the printing.
Yoon explains that sign makers buy the shapes his company makes, then they attach LED lights to them for advertising.
To make, you know, the shape into metal, take a long time, you need a lot of manpower, right? Cost is high.
Making these complicated shapes by hand would take a lot of time, but 1AM has built a machine that does it quick.
Yeah, can you show me how it all works?
Yoon brings me over to a computer and starts punching in some coordinates.
Transfer the computer, push the button, this way is moving, and then bending the shape, the outline.
It starts bending and cutting the metal that will eventually be turned into an LED line character.
Almost got hit by a piece of metal right there.
Now I'm standing in front of an enormous printer whose head is swinging back and forth like a huge pendulum. It's a prototype made by the Korean firm Digital Illustrate Incorporated.
Radio program.
It's a radio program, that's why I have this thing.
Uh-huh.
I stick my mic in front of company representative Park Dae-bok.
This is the biggest printer I've ever seen in my life, so I just wanted to ask you, how big are the signs that it makes?
5 meters.
5 meters long. So these signs that you make with this printer, what's the material that it prints onto?
Yes, we have experienced to test already. So Starflex film, some kind of film, and then the sticker paper, yeah, something like that.
Cool. And how much do one of these bad boys cost?
Oh, sorry, sir. As I told you, this machine is prototype. And over this year, yes, we will be the final cost.
In the back of the convention center, there's a sort of hall of fame for award-winning signs. It seems that whoever picks these winners enjoys seafood, as most of the signs are from fish restaurants. There's a 2 meter long blueback fish for a restaurant of the same name. Here's a sign for an eel restaurant with glowing white letters set in front of rice paper that is made to resemble the way you cook this eel over an open fire. And behind me is another sign for a fish restaurant called Dreaming Fish. You can actually reach out and touch the scales of this glowing white fish. I'm no ichthyologist, but it looks like a carp to me. But in a country where almost everyone has a smart device, are signs still the best way to reach consumers? I put that question to manager Kim Tae-young.
I feel the most effective way to advertise is still signs. Even though people are into their iPhones or tablets and still search for things using that technology, signs still work. Businesses still prefer to use physical signs to advertise their products.
So whether they're light-up fish, 3D letters, or blinding LEDs, signs aren't coming down anytime soon. For Monocle in Seoul, I'm Jason Strother.
And you can hear more from Design Stories on this week's edition of Section D, which premieres here on Monocle 24. That's at 6 a.m. in Sydney, 1900 hours if you're here in London, and 11 a.m. in the morning if you happen to be in San Francisco.
You're listening to Midori House. We'll be right back after this with a museum controversy in Sao Paulo.
Each Sunday on Monocle 24, we like to take stock.
The wonder of history for the journalist is you can delve into this immense booty of information.
I don't even know what to think about that.
Take the global pulse.
I was at a Bunga Bunga party the other day.
And?
I wasn't at all. I just wanted to start a show like that. We're 187 shows down. How's your week been?
I'm feeling 187, actually.
And occasionally take things down a notch too.
I had a pair of plum suede loafers with gold snaffles. And a guy stopped his car and leant out of the window and said it was people like me who were bringing this country to its knees.
To end the week with the best chat,
We know that he had them, and we know that he'd used them before.
Because we still had the receipts.
Well, there's that.
Some great music.
Do you know, I never thought that I might need to have a question about death metal, but I'm warming up.
And some good fun to set up Sunday and warm the week ahead. The Monocle Weekly. Your week starts here.
Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House. The time is 8:39 here in London, 6:39 in the morning in Sao Paulo, where we are headed next. Now, MASP, or simply the Sao Paulo Museum of Art, is one of the most important museums in South America and an icon for South America's largest city. The building was designed by iconic architect Lina Bobardi, and one of its main features is the freestanding space underneath it.
It was meant to be a place for people to meet, but recently it seems to have been taken over by homeless families, and there were also reports of the area turning into a hotspot for drug sales. And in June, it hosted some of the demonstrations that sprung up across Brazil. Conservative newspaper O Estado de São Paulo suggested it should be fenced off, but the more liberal papers and some architects say that's the opposite of what Bardi would have wanted to see.
Well, for more on how the fascinating building defines the city of São Paulo and what perhaps went so wrong for it, we welcome Adrian Forti in the studio, professor of architectural history at the Bartlett School of Architecture. Welcome to the program, Adrian. Just set the scene for us, for those of us that are listening that may not be familiar with this building. It's quite an iconic building in the city, isn't it?
Yeah, well, hello. The MASP building is in central downtown São Paulo. It's on the Avenue Paulista, which is a big, wide road, main road, running through downtown São Paulo. And the Avenue Paulista runs along a ridge when the land falls away on one side. And the site where the MASP building was originally was a public garden, well, the Belvedere, where you could look out over the rest of the city. And so when Lina Bobardi was commissioned to design this building, she wanted to protect this view. And her solution to this was to build a building which is on four massive great legs. And the building rests on these, but at ground level, there's no building there at all. Mm. It's like a building that has no ground floor. And there's simply this enormous open space underneath the building, which originally allowed you to see the view out over the rest of the city, and which acts as this extraordinary space which is used for all kinds of things.
And what sort of, I mean, obviously we went through some of the things which perhaps are a little less savoury in our introduction there, but are there other things as well which folk are using it for, which exemplify that it's a civic space for all to use?
Well, ever since the building was opened, it was used for rallies, for concerts, for demonstrations, markets, you know, everything possible. I mean, you have to realize that in this part of São Paulo, there's very, very little public open space. It's a really packed, dense city. There aren't spaces where people can meet together and do big things together in public. And this space here, it's really extraordinary. It's a magnificent gift to the city that the museum and Lina Bobardi provided.
I'm looking at a picture of the building right now, and as you can, I'm just going to show you, there's that space you described. It's a mammoth space underneath the building. But what strikes me is that there's absolutely nothing on it. It's a completely empty space. So what reason would a resident of Sao Paulo have to go there? There aren't any cafes, there aren't benches even. There really isn't a reason for them to go there unless they're perhaps wanting to look at the view.
Because people go there to create events. Well, they go there to go to the museum. It's the way into the museum is across that space. But they go there because people go there to meet together. And as I say, you know, if you want to have an outdoor market, which happens rather conveniently to be covered as well because it's underneath the building, you can have it there. If you want to have a open air concert that's conveniently protected, it can take place there. That's the kind of thing which is so difficult to set up or find a space for in São Paulo that this building makes possible. It gives the city a social life.
And the fact that there's no retail there actually makes it more democratic. I mean, as an architect that I know in Belgrade, who said people here think all the pavement cafes are very charming, but you have to pay for a cup of coffee to sit there. If we've got open public spaces in squares and such like, that's free for everybody to use as they like. And this is how the Paulistas have taken this space, I presume.
Exactly. It's nobody controls it. It's there for everybody to use. There's no commercial interest that's operating it. It's great.
But then what's went so wrong with this space then?
Well, the problem about it is that, you know, in any city, any large city, a big undefined space attracts all sorts of elements, and you will get what are perceived as being antisocial elements as well as social elements. That's part of a society, that it has a mix of things. And what I understand is happening now is that it's been taken over by homeless people who are camping there. And you've got some crack dealers hanging around there. This is not a new problem. It's always been a problem with this space under the building. And people have managed it up to now and they managed to negotiate it. And I see no reason why they shouldn't be able to go on doing that. But there's always been tension around this, you know, ever since the building opened in the late 60s.
Can you see any parallels with what's happened to the South Bank Centre here in London, where you have a self-defined area for skateboarding, which now the proposals to redefine that as a commercial area? Is it a similar sort of thing, do you think?
It's a very similar case. It's a building of the same vintage, designed in the 60s. It has quite an idealistic, utopian sort of view of society. And the South Bank Centre here is an obvious parallel to that. And the temptation is for somebody to come along and say, oh, we'll close it up, we'll make it safe, we'll turn it into a commercial space. And yet, you know, part of living in a city is having these kinds of undefined spaces where anything can happen. And that's what the managers of cities find so difficult to accept, is, you know, that's what living in a city is about.
And are you finding that that's the case around the world, that these public spaces, which have been open for so long to everyone, and as Guy said, very democratically, are now under risk from commercialization?
I think it's a pretty general trend. We seem to have managed in Western Europe to hold on to a certain amount of freedom in public open spaces, but it's always a pressure. This, it's a tension, and you know it's never going to be resolved. But we got to live with this.
Excellent stuff, Adrian. Thanks very much for joining us here in the studio, Adrian Forty, a professor of architectural history at the Bartlett School of Architecture. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
We'll have time for a look at today's European front pages in a moment. But before that, music from Switzerland, very carefully chosen. This is, it really was, this is Who You Are by Zwicker featuring Heidi Happy. Zwicker featuring Heidi Happy with Who You Are.
And indeed was very carefully selected, wasn't it, Guy?
It was indeed.
Before the show, there was lots of song were we going
to
play?
We were trying to find out who would be the best Swiss artist to drop in there. And my vote was for Yellow, but it was...
You were overruled, I think.
I was crushed.
Well, I think Heidi Happy was a very good choice.
It wasn't bad, was it? Although it would have been interesting to hear some young gods on Monocle 24, I think.
Well, it's a good choice, especially because we are now joined in the studio by Alexa Firmenich, who is going to look through some of this morning's European front pages. Welcome to the show, Alexa.
Good morning.
Where should we begin this morning?
I'd like to begin with something from El País, which is actually a story from Italy. And on Sunday, over the weekend, there was a massive fire in a textile factory quite close to Tuscany in Italy. And what happened in this fire is it highlighted an issue that is quite known in the region, but at least in international news, it hasn't been covered as much. And it's a massive trade with Chinese workers in this part of Italy. You have around 4,000 Chinese-owned businesses with around over 50,000 illegal workers. And what happened was 7 workers died on Sunday. So that sort of brings to the fore this huge issue that's happening in this part of Italy.
And we could get onto the details of the fire in a minute, but this is very intriguing because the image that people have these days of the garment industry in particular is that it's moved east and to East and Southeast Asia. Mm-hmm. And yet here we seem to have a situation where it's the workers themselves who've moved. What are the advantages for these operations of importing workers and basing them in Europe?
I think it's just proximity to the whole made in Italy, the retailers from Italy, and it's actually putting a lot of Italian low-cost garment makers out of business. And a lot of these factories and facilities are owned by Chinese organized crime. And actually the mayor of the town says that it's the largest concentration of black market labor in Italy's central north and probably in all of Europe.
But, you know, it's quite a staggering number of potentially 50,000 workers mm-hmm. In this part of Italy. How could it have gone so unnoticed? Wouldn't people be asking questions?
It has been noticed in the region, but what he says happens is they close down one factory, everyone relocates, opens up under a different name, and they just move to a different place. It's very, very hard to actually regulate this. And there needs to be greater coordination between Italy and China on these businesses and on these workers who live apparently in houses with metal bars, €1 an hour, 16 hours a day working in these facilities.
And this is the thing, and I lived in Cambodia for 8 years where there's a very big garment industry, 500,000 people. It's regulated by the International Labour Organization, supposedly to ensure fair working conditions. Well, what's the point of that if you're just going to move everybody to Tuscany and treat them like cattle?
No, exactly. So, I mean, it will be interesting to see if they can really clamp down after this fire. That's at least highlighted the issue a little bit more than previously.
It's probably a bit too soon, but no idea where these textiles were being used. No idea on the kind of the brands that perhaps were using these textiles.
This one was for an Italian brand, and most of them do go to Italian brands around the country.
Okay. Well, let's. You have an interesting story here about the Swiss Army. What can you tell us about it?
Well, as you may know, the Swiss Army is going through quite an important restructuring at the moment.
Will the knives be affected?
No. Don't worry. The knives are safe. Okay. And it's causing a lot of debate within Switzerland because every region, you know, the French-speaking region, the Italian region, the German region, everyone does want to hold on to their bases and their facilities. These are sources of pride, of jobs. So today in La Tribune de Genève, the Minister of Defense, Juli Maurer, has come out more or less for the first time since these measures were starting to be put into place last week. And he says that the French part of Switzerland isn't losing out on the adjustments because there was a lot of debate. There are 4 bases being closed, but he's promised that investments will continue around €500 million over the coming 5 years. The big issue, however, in the French part of Switzerland is the closure of this aerodrome facility in Sion, which is eliminating over 50 jobs.
How do these inter-ethnic rivalries? What would you call it exactly? Inter-canton rivalries? Whatever they are, they, between the different language groups, how do they look on the ground?
It's funny. It's like even the French and the Swiss. I mean, everyone's so similar at the end of the day, but people do, you have French-speaking French in the French part of Switzerland and sometimes, you know, German-speaking press in the German part. And often they don't say the same thing at all. And it is really interesting. And so, you know, whenever you do have to pull in a policy like this across the entire country, you have competition between the different sides.
And probably no cuts to the Pope's Swiss Guards.
You've got to hope not.
No. That would be worrisome. You have one last story for us, Alexa. It's all about sheep.
Yeah, well, if you'd like to take a look at the sheep in question here. What you can see before you is a
proud-looking beast.
Very, very noble.
It looks like one of those sheep from the film Babe. Mm. Don't you think?
Wasn't that about pigs?
No, but there was also sheep in it.
I'd forgotten that. I'd blanked it from my memory.
Come on.
I don't think the people who bought that for around a million euros would be very happy.
A million? Tell us about it then.
So it's these sheep sculptures that were created by a French artist who passed away quite recently called François-Xavier Lalanne. And a collection of them were bought for over a million francs over the weekend at an auction in Switzerland. One of them, which is one you see called Le Mouton Chocolat, sold for around $600,000, and altogether they form a herd. And these sheep have graced the houses of Coco Chanel, Yves Saint Laurent, even Dali at a certain point in time.
Don't tell my children about chocolate sheep, otherwise they'll want one.
Well, yeah.
And I'm not paying $600,000 for one.
And is there anything special about its coat? Is it actually real sheep fur? Or
It's wool? Made out of wool.
Okay, so nothing that special about it.
No. No, okay. You'd wonder why, but I guess maybe it's the legacy of where these sheep have been.
It's a very beautiful looking sheep at that. Alexa, thanks very much for joining us here in the studio. Alexa Firmanich.
And that is all we have time for today. Thanks very much to our producer, Marcus Hippie, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and Rosie Sells. Our studio manager was Bill Luty. Up after the news, we've got the Entrepreneurs Monocle's business program. Both me and Phil will be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow, won't we, Phil?
Trouble.
But now, from me, Guy Delorne.
And from me, Phil Hahn. Thanks very much for listening and goodbye.
Why this watch? This watch is a witness. A witness to words that moved nations. It's dead men faster, further. It's been worn by luminaries, visionaries, champions. It doesn't just tell time. It tells history. Rolex.